Hello and welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I'm your host, Ben Davison. And with me, as always, is the lovely, the fantastic, the sneezing left-wing columnist and superstar extraordinaire, Van Badham, and our dog, Germanicus.
Who is on my lap, hence the reason I may be sneezing. I think you're covered in dust, Germ.
Well, we have a big show today. There's obviously been a lot going on this week. We're going to talk a bit about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's passed away, Trump's determination to nominate a new Supreme Court justice and what that might mean for the election and for Australia and for the world.
For the world.
We're going to talk a little bit about payday loan sharks and what's going on there. There was a promise to fix this up some 3 years ago, and now it looks like that's been reversed, but we'll get into that shortly. And our good news today is that it appears as though the drought is breaking, and you might even hear rain on our roof, but most importantly of all, it seems like the drought is breaking in New South Wales.
Yeah, which is incredibly good news, especially if people remember the height of it last year while the bushfires was going on. It was like a dust bowl. It was an absolutely terrifying time.
So let's dive straight into it. Van, tell us about what's happened with Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Okay, so Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a justice of the American Supreme Court, the Supreme Court of the United States, commonly known as SCOTUS, which looks obscene and apparently is not, although it possibly could be. She was appointed by Clinton in 1993. She had quite a distinguished career as a lawyer before that. She really made her name fighting sex discrimination cases. Particularly, she was a champion of women's equal pay rights in America, and she was quite a pop icon. She was nicknamed the Notorious RBG, which was a name that she embraced. She was the only the second woman ever to sit on the Supreme Court, and for most of her tenure was the only woman on the court. She was actually appointed by Clinton as a moderate, so her appointment was to bridge the divide between the conservatives and the liberals on the Supreme Court. But because the court moved so much to the right over the course of her tenure, she became associated with being on the liberal wing and was the most senior liberal judge on. And of course, liberal means something very different in America than to what it means in Australia, meaning the champions of a progressive ideology. And obviously was very committed to issues like marriage equality and women's equality and progressive causes. She was 87 until she died, like at the point that she died, which is recently, from pancreatic cancer. It was actually the fifth bout of cancer that she'd had. Which is kind of extraordinary. And there was a lot of controversy about her not resigning from the court at a time when there was a Democratic president, because obviously in the United States, one of the quirks of their system is that the president makes a nomination for a Supreme Court judge, which is approved by the Senate. Over the years, there has been a conservative majority, thin as it is. It has been a 5-4 majority, even though there have been some progressive decisions made by the Supreme Court, because I can't remember how long it is, but essentially of the justices over the past 50 years, 14 have been appointed by Republicans, I believe it's 14, but only 4 by Democrats.
Right, so quite an imbalance.
Which of course has massive implications for decisions around things like abortion rights and marriage equality and equality issues and campaign funding issues, all of these sort of.
And the Supreme Court upheld the travel ban, Trump's travel ban as well, didn't it?
It did. It upheld Trump's travel ban. They're unpredictable because they will make decisions based on points of law. There are justices who are committed to constitutional intentionalism, which is an idea or original. I can't remember if it's
constructionists.
They're constitutional originalists, and they believe that all decisions have to be made through the framework about thinking what a bunch of white and slave-owning men decided in the 18th century was how they wanted the country to look and things like that. So It is quite a fraught time in America. And obviously, Bader Ginsburg dying now means there is a vacancy. And the Republicans themselves established a precedent back during the Obama administration when there was the death of Antonin Scalia, who was a very conservative judge, actually best friends with Ruth Bader Ginsburg because the world is an infinitely curious place. When Antonin Scalia died, Barack Obama had the opportunity of nominating a replacement, and he put up a candidate called Merrick Garland, who was an impeccably credentialed candidate.
Yep.
And it was 240-something days, 243 days, I believe, before the 2016 election.
Yep.
But the Republicans, led by Mitch McConnell in the Senate, refused to appoint him, saying it was an election year, which was, of course, you know, could have been any year.
Yeah.
But they made a big song and dance about how it was totally inappropriate for there to be a nomination during an election year, and they blocked the appointment of Merrick Garland with this sort of spurious election year argument. Well, now it is an election year again. Donald Trump is down in the polls, and there are mere 40 days until the election.
Yeah.
But Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell are pressing ahead, trying to rush through the appointment of a new justice to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, even though apparently it was her dying wish that the reappointment not occur until a new president was sworn in. But we are where we are. And obviously, Trump's base, there are a lot of people who are very keen to strip abortion rights from American women. And even though the standard reappointment process takes a long time, like it takes months.
Yeah.
And there are only 40 days until the election.
Because these are lifetime appointments as well. So you don't want to really rush a lifetime appointment.
You only leave if you retire or die. So they are literal lifetime appointments, which is one of the reasons why the court has been so conservative in the past, because you had people who appointed for like 40 years.
Yeah.
And certainly the conservatives, there's been quite a lot of conservative activism around appointing judges who are quite young, like in their 40s, with the intention that they will be conservative justices on that court forever and ever and ever. And people are saying that if Trump gets his way and appoints one of his shortlist, that that person would be affecting American jurisprudence for the next three generations and weighting the Supreme Court, you know, short of one of them getting hit by a bus for some time. So the really interesting thing about what's happening, of course, is that in the context of an election, it's a massive political issue, and Democrats have just gone absolutely bonkers because RBG was so well known and so admired and such an icon, really, of feminism and progressive judicialism.
Well, Claire Wright, the Australian historian, is involved in a project where they're building a statue of Ruth Bader Ginsburg in New York, I see, and may well be building one of Zelda Soprano.
Oh, wow.
Here in Australia. Yeah. So,
because they're all champions of equal pay.
Yeah.
Zelda Soprano, everybody, was famously the Melbourne trade unionist who chained herself to a government building and led the campaign for equal pay in Australia. So, anyway, the Democrats' outrage at, you know, the hypocrisy of the Republicans, and it is just absolute outright hypocrisy, has meant the Democrats have taken in their largest fundraising haul from donations from people, channeling money towards Senate races in America. Because obviously, if the composition of the Senate changes, so does the Democrats would have the power to block the appointment of a new justice if Trump can't get it done before the election, which is, of course, highly unlikely. And there are other things the Democrats can do, like if the Nancy Pelosi decides to shut down Congress, that makes it difficult for the Senate to meet. There's a number of things that could happen. But certainly the fundraising haul from the Democrats is like nothing anybody has ever seen. They are literally being flooded with money. And there's a belief that it could really make a difference in a lot of Senate races where Democrats were competitive but struggling. Incidentally, one of those races is in South Carolina, where Lindsey Graham, who the Republican who very famously said, "You can hold me to my word. There is no way I'm ever going to support the..." I'm now doing impersonations. Lindsey Graham very famously in the last in the appointment of Merrick Garland, went on the interview circuit and was talking about how it was absolutely appalling that this justice was being appointed in an election year, and famously said, "You can hold me to my word. You can hold me to my word." Well, they are. And money is flooding to Jamie Harrison, who his opponent in South Carolina, and they're now neck and neck in the polls. There are some really interesting political considerations around this, where some journalists and commentators have suggested that the right to life movement in America, the anti-choice people who hate abortion and have a real problem with feminists, they will become quite... A lot of evangelicals have fallen out of love with Donald Trump because he is, of course, you know, a serial liar who pays off porn stars and is just a deplorable human being who cages children at the border.
He's the antithesis of Christianity, really.
He really is. Having spent some time myself reading the foundational text of that religion, again, the people who Trump resembles the most are not the heroes of that story. But there is a concern that those kind of people who've lost interest in Trump will come back in order to get the justice so they can, of course, fight campaigns to restrict abortion rights in America even further. But the alternative opinion, and this, I read a brilliant article by William Crystal, who is, of course, a notorious conservative who himself was an activist for conservative judicial appointments over the years. He wrote that politically it's probably not going to favour Trump. And his argument is that it's quite obvious, like Donald Trump is on record talking about how he thought that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was incompetent. And now, of course, he's like, oh, yeah, she was a great lady, but give me money and I'm going to appoint other people. And so it's quite obvious that Biden is the RBG candidate, basically. Mm. William Crystal was saying that the other thing is, in terms of in the integrity of the court and supporting constitutional processes, the fact that the Republicans have been exposed as complete hypocrites on this issue means that it gives Biden the advantage of being seen as a champion of the Supreme Court and judicial integrity. And the third thing was that, and William Crystal is notoriously anti-abortion as well, he said, look, I may be opposed to abortion, but 70% of Americans support Roe versus Wade. Actually, it's one of the most unifying political issues in America. And this whole discussion makes Biden the pro, it makes him the pro-choice candidate and makes him the Roe versus Wade candidate. So the political discussion actually favours Biden in terms of looking at where votes might be, they're probably on Biden's side. And the fact that it's mobilised like millions of Americans into the fight and with their money is quite conspicuous.
Because that's the thing that I think a lot of Australians probably wouldn't be across is how political that whole process is. Yes, it's a nominee from the president and it's appointed by the, or confirmed by the Senate. And in Australia, of course, the government appoints high court judges as well. But it's not a politically activist event here in the way that it is there. They have protests there. They were picketing outside
they
Mitchell
run
Cole's
advertising
house.
Campaigns.
Oh, Lindsey Graham's house, weren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah. But they run advertising campaigns.
Yeah.
Like to pressure, call your senators, do this, do that. You know, and that just doesn't happen here. You know, our sense of a separate judiciary, even though there are government appointments, is really, really important democratic virtue in Australia, that we don't politicise judicial appointment processes. And when there have been, you know, conspicuous political anomalies, like the situation in Queensland during the Campbell Newman government, where there was a judicial appointment that was highly controversial because it was quite obviously a political appointment, all hell broke loose, you know, and the judiciary would not stand for it.
That's right.
And this is the thing, when there have been attacks, and I was writing the other day about Michael Kirby, very famous High Court judge in Australia, when he was being targeted by Bill Heffernan. I don't know if you remember the liberal Bill Heffernan, who had fabricated Comcar records and was implying that Kirby was out, you know, picking up hookups in a Comcar, which was all entirely untrue. In Australia, that was a massive issue. You had condemnation motions from the Senate. You had, like, legal uprising. The legal community was furious and the people were furious as well.
Not like against that, Kirby, but against Heffernan.
Oh, against Heffernan, absolutely. Yeah. Heffernan was, like, John Howard, who is his factional ally, was forced to sack him.
Yeah.
Like, and it was the politician who went down, not the judge. And so, you know, for us, it's a very different thing to consider how politicised these processes are in America. But just to put this in context, like the determination to strike down Roe versus Wade and to deny women basic reproductive freedom, the one of the people on the short list that Trump is proposing is a woman called Amy Barrett, who was on record saying the role of judiciary in America is to build the kingdom of God.
That's quite scary, really.
That's kind of scary. That is Handmaid's Tale stuff.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you're a Catholic and you have a strong belief in God, but the belief in the separation of church and state is so fundamental to the proper functioning of a democracy. I mean, we see all around the world where whatever the religion is, where there is a breakdown of those lines, then the freedoms of people to be who they are and to have the communities that they want collapse very quickly as well.
Well, this is what I always say. Yes, I am a Catholic and I'm, you know, entrenched in my beliefs. The protection of my freedom to have those beliefs is a secular state. When my family immigrated to this country, it was because in their country of origin, their Catholicism meant they couldn't buy, own or inherit land and they were subject to legal discrimination based on their religion. And if anybody is a champion of religious freedom, it is keeping state institutions as secular as possible and defending anti-discrimination law. That is the most important value. Not imposing your religious beliefs over somebody else's is a fairly crucial factor of the religious freedom thing. And I'm just, the abortion thing always astounds me because I'm like, if you don't believe in abortion, don't have one.
Yep.
I will absolutely march in the street with a big placard that says pro-choice because I genuinely don't believe in in a restriction of choice on that particular issue. So it is absolutely stunning. But I didn't know that support for Roe versus Wade was so intense in America. And of course, there's a longer conversation to be had there about Ruth Bader Ginsburg herself was like this: the campaign for abortion rights should have been won politically in America, like it was in Europe, like it was in Australia, where the populations and the governments came along and enshrined abortion rights and reproductive rights in law through like a mechanism of popular will, as opposed to in the United States where it was a judicial decision that bound governments. And she was always of the opinion, even though she was a champion of those rights, she was like, this is problematic because we don't have the channel to we haven't used the channel of a democratic legislation of these rights. Yeah. So we are where we are, but certainly the women of America, I mean, there was an extraordinary piece in one of the American newspapers about how women were texting one another when they found out Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. They were all texting one another just one word, and it was a word that began with F. So,
which we've promised Apple podcasts.
Which we've promised Apple podcasts we will not use. But yeah, it's interesting times ahead, and it's just one more log on the bonfire of American democracy.
Well, look, it's watch this space, I think, is the kind of end point of that. It's a highly complex issue. It's highly political. It's highly emotional, as most things seem to be over there at the moment. And it really could go almost any which way. And I think, you know, in Australia, we need to not underestimate the tension that this circumstance brings about, because it's off the charts over there. You know, if people are texting each other, people are running ads, people are picketing senators' homes, you've got both sides of politics that were already very polarized, now absolutely polarized. I can't imagine how you could push them further apart now. And there's 40 something days till the election. So.
Oh, it's incredible what's going on there. I mean, you and I watched Q&A on Monday night, which was, of course, a discussion about American politics. And even just watching that 1 hour of television was so anxiety provoking and stressful and hostile and divisive. I said this on Twitter, like, if you think this is bad, try living in the United States of America. Like, my God, what must it be like at the moment? And of course, it is an absolute absolute basket case.
So one of the, I think it's a good time to move on to our other issue, the payday lenders issue, because payday lending is something that is really big in the US, where you've got a really low minimum wage, you've got really high expenses for things like education, for healthcare, you know, people essentially living paycheck to paycheck.
Ben, you might want to explain to everybody what payday loans are.
So payday loans are essentially where you go to a lender and you guarantee a loan from them using your paycheck. So you guarantee that you'll pay back whatever money you need to fill the gap between where you are in your pay cycle and your next pay. Now, these are usually very vulnerable people. They're often using this facility if they're on very low wages, they have some kind of emergency, but often also just to keep ahead of their usual cost of living. A facility that is often described as, oh, well, if you have an unexpected emergency, the fridge breaks down, you need something replaced in your car so you can get to work, use this facility. What actually tends to happen is that people get locked into a cycle of having to take out a loan every pay cycle in order to keep up with paying off the loan. Can be a vicious, vicious cycle. And some of the stats on this are that people are paying up to 200% interest. This has come out. So, Van, you've been really active in this space, and I know you've worked with consumer groups around this as well. Can you talk to us just a little bit about the history here? Because this was something that was promised to be fixed, I think, 3 years ago.
Yeah, it was. So I did some work with the Consumer Action Law Centre, who are fantastic. Literally, the name is there. They are a consumer rights advocacy legal outfit, and they do a lot of campaigning around stopping financial exploitation of people. So things like they represent people around reform to things like hire purchase, and they represented a lot of people in the Banking Royal Commission, mm-hmm. and they're a really effective organisation. I did some work with them facilitating some discussions and writing some articles around the payday loans and the fact that this is an exploitation of poverty within the economy, that the people who are least capable of repaying loans are the ones who use them, and that they do get trapped into these cycles of debt. The issue is that it shouldn't be allowed. Like, it's exploitation, and it does trap people in cycles of dependency and this constant sort of loan, and bankrupts people and eviscerates people's capacity to support themselves financially, because you're paying back loans as opposed to being able to develop savings or participate in any kind of financial hygiene, frankly. And there was a promise that this loophole was going to be closed, like the loophole that allowed this was going to be closed, and that protection for people would be enshrined. I mean, we know that there are abuses that go on in the Australian financial system all the time. Some of the things that came out in the Banking Royal Commission about unscrupulous behaviour around lending were absolutely staggering. My favourite, and I use that word in sarcasm form, was, of course, the insurance company that was selling funeral insurance to Indigenous baby and trapping Indigenous families into these financial contribution arrangements where they were paying $30,000 over a period of time for insurance that was only worth $14,000 but couldn't get out of the contract without invalidating the insurance. And, you know, these are the kind of abuses that go on in our financial system all the time. The idea that payday lending, which is very, it's dodgy, Ben, it is dodgy, that the government wouldn't be taking action on that. I'm very curious, Ben, as to why they aren't taking action on that.
So what seems to have happened is this was promised about 3 years ago just after the 2016 election and in 2017 by Turnbull, that this would be something that they would fix. They recognised this was a problem. Now, George Christensen, the Queensland LNP MP up there, has railed against doing anything about this, that these are decisions that individuals make for themselves and we shouldn't be restricting individual choice, and basically trying to paper over the fact that there is massive amounts of exploitation in this system. And what the government put forward, so there's a government bill, right? So there's a law that the government has written. It has consulted with the opposition on it, and it would have limited the repayments essentially to being no more than 10% of a person's income. Right, so you could still get a payday loan, but the repayments on this would have to be structured in a way so as to not make you dependent on always having to get another payday loan. Now, this went to a Senate inquiry. This Senate inquiry has been dragged out for, well, years, actually. Like, when you consider how fast they rush through major pieces of legislation, sometimes in weeks, it's amazing that this has taken 3 years. And now, of course, what's happened is that the government-controlled Senate committee has actually written against the bill. So a government bill has gone to this Senate inquiry, and the government-controlled committee has said that the government shouldn't pass the bill, shouldn't make it law. Now, Labor's written a dissenting report and pointed out all these horrible elements of exploitation, the 200% interest, the fact that there's been 300,000 young people taking up payday loans in July of this year. So you think about it, a crisis like we've had with the pandemic, people who don't have any income, who are desperate to be able to pay their bills, have gone to payday loans. 300,000 of them, young people. Now, they may well be trapped in that cycle for most of their adult life as a result. And the government has said, oh, well, that's their individual choice. I mean,
Their individual choice.
Their individual choice. You know, it's this constant belief that your circumstances are your own and are always of your own making, regardless of where you were born, what family you're born to, regardless of the resources available to you and the infrastructure available to you and the opportunities available to you, you've always got all of the choices to make. The reality of that, of course, is that that's not true. And for a Queensland LNP MP from up near Mackay to suggest that people just can make whatever choice they like is so misleading, such an abuse of trust from the people who have elected him, that it really makes me sick in my stomach, because it's obvious to anyone who compares the opportunities around this country that they're not equal everywhere. They're not equal for everyone all the time. And to say, oh, well, we're not going to protect you from exploitation from these people who have a lot of money, from these companies who have a lot of access to political decision makers. We're not going to protect you from them because it's your choice to get sucked in by them and to be exploited by them is just an appalling abrogation of the responsibility of our government.
But it's also, I mean, it's sociologically just dunderheaded, frankly, because we are not all individuals. We are a society. And of course, if you're son or daughter is getting, who's, you know, out of work in an unstable circumstance, if they're getting payday loans and they're trapped into a cycle of poverty, that affects you as their parent. Like, that will impact decisions you given the, you know, whatever, depending on the structure of your family. But that also affects partners, that affects children. Like, you know, these entire communities of people, families are affected by these decisions. They don't happen in isolation. And for George Christensen to pretend that they're, you know, that this is just something you bring on yourself, well, this is not something that...
he's gone even
sorry,
further.
It's just, it is enraging. I can barely speak about it. And of course it's George Christensen. Of course it is. A man who has made a political career about not taking responsibility for anything he does, like speaking at far-right rallies and legitimising platforms for white supremacists. But I guess it's just an individual decision. He's just, you know, but he doesn't take responsibility for the implications of that. But you, poor person, have to take responsibility for a payday loan and a financial penury that affects your entire family and community. What an absolute pillock. I'm sorry. Apple, I hope pillock is fine, because I'm doing my best right now, let me tell you.
Yeah. I mean, I did happen to catch part of him speaking about this in Parliament, where he really... you know, he's no shame about it, frankly. Maybe we just shouldn't, you know, attack the financial lenders who do this. No, quite the opposite. He praises them as helping people.
He praises the financial lenders who trap poor people into lifetime cycles of debt. Well, I think that says much about the Liberal National Party of Queensland and the values of the coalition more broadly. George Christensen, thank you very much.
Yep. So, again, you know, we'll see how this plays out, because it'll be something that the government's going to have to address. It was its piece of legislation, and now its committee members who have said it should not be passed. So, but let's talk about some good news, because we're almost done for
and
this
I'm
week.
I'm having a rage aneurysm, yes. I'd just like to point out, listeners, the dog is very firmly asleep on me. Like, I'm like, rah, 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 George Christensen. The dog's snoozing away.
He's used to it. So the drought is breaking in New South Wales.
Oh, thank God for that. What is that going to mean in terms of bushfire season, Ben? Do we know?
I don't know what it's going to mean for this bushfire season. I know what it will do in terms of giving the bush much better chance of recovery after the last bushfire season. So we're going to see more growth. Now, that will need to be managed, of course. But the good news about this is it means there's water in the dams, there's water in the reservoirs. You know, there's going to be there's going to be a chance for the forests to recover properly and get some proper growth. We're seeing huge increases now in crop yields as well for farmers right around the country. But in New South Wales, crop yields are up 300%.
Wow.
So, you know, that will have knock-on effects. Well, hopefully will have knock-on effects in terms of things like simple things like the price of bread. You know, we forget sometimes that things like the price of bread are impacted by crop yields. Well, when you come out of a drought, crop yields go up. Grain prices go down, hopefully, domestically, and they can actually have some influence over people's simple cost of living. It's a really good situation. So only 2.6% of New South Wales is now still officially in drought. When you consider that part of New South Wales is actually a desert, that's a really amazing situation. And the La Nina phenomenon means that most of the east coast of Australia, north of Gippsland, is going to have above average rainfalls between October and December. It seems weird for us to be so excited about rainfall, but in a country where we've had drought for much of the last decade, in fact, you can probably hear the rain on our roof.
Here it comes. It was beautifully well-timed.
It's a really, really good piece of news. And we wish everyone who is going to be impacted by this in a really positive way all the very best, because I know they've been really hanging out for
this to
happen.
You're a farm boy at heart, Benny. You really are.
Well, I got to tell you, it's you see the smiles on people's faces when they've been doing a decade of tough yards, hard yards, and you know, it really brings a warmth to you on the inside, I think. So I'm really pleased for particularly those farmers in New South Wales who did lose a lot during the fires and during the drought, and now they got a chance to start to recover. So that's the good news, and that's the week on Wednesday. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Apple or Google or Podbean or Spotify. You can email us theweekonwednesday@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter, Week on Wednesday. And you can also follow us on Facebook, The Week on Wednesday. Remember to recommend us to your friends, share the links, and let us know what you think of the show. We're really keen to hear from you and get topics from you.
We love getting topics for people. And also, if there are people you're interested in us interviewing on certain subjects, give us a suggestion and we'll give it a burl.
And as usual, we will make our very best endeavours to live tweet both insiders and Q&A. And if there are any other shows you'd like to get the Week on Wednesday's opinion on as well, let us know.
We got opinions to burn in this house, let me tell you. Opinions.
We sure do. All right. Thanks, everybody. Love you, Vanny.
Love you too, baby.
Bye.